here started. So like I said, we're the second half, we're going to talk more about some stuff that is, I call it practical business stuff. It won't be quite ready for you guys yet, because I don't think any of you are going to graduate in a month or two and then go hang your shingle over the summer. But it helps you to understand kind of what's going on with how an office runs and some thoughts that you guys, people don't even think about. There was a lot of, if you guys, sorry, I just didn't get the thing last night. I completely forgot, but hopefully you got the notes. If you look, there's lots of numbers on it. There will not be math questions on the exam about this stuff. You can tell your friends the same thing. So whatever you see on, when you see numbers and adding it up and everything else, you don't have to worry about me asking a question saying, this cost was this, and this was this, and what does it actually cost? What I wanted to do is I wanted to give you guys, this is as much about understanding kind of some things that people don't think about and understanding the process. So there may be a question on the process involved as opposed to doing math calculations. But we're going to do a little bit of math today. Not a lot. But you can understand, so you understand how an office works. So, the first thing we're going to do is talk about, so when you get out there, you got to figure out, like, how do I charge? What do I charge people for my services? As I said, most people, when they're going to get out, they're going to work for a company. So your rates are going to be set, like my rates are set. But then what ends up happening is after a certain point in time, the company you work for, they have a profitability factor figured in, all the accountants. And I'm not a numbers guy. I did really well in math, but I like accounting and numbers, it's like all woogie to me. So I let somebody else take care of that. But when I go out to my clients and I have this rate, an hourly rate, and I have to look at my profitability at the firm and where the margins are, I can have some flexibility. So I need to understand that. So that's part of what I want to show you here. Not necessarily what you guys need to charge or when you first get out, but eventually you're going to be in a situation where maybe you are making the decisions about your rates and what you have to think about and how those numbers come together. So, first thing one is, how do we determine fees? Now, what we're going to do is we're going to go through the different types of models. We talked about them before. There's percentage of cost of work, there's a lump sum, and there's hourly. I've talked about those before, but I'm going to break it down. When you're calculating the fee for your client, and this will help you explain to them, because the client's going to say, well, how do you charge? And in fact, I was just negotiating a contract with an architect, and their contract was written based on an hourly basis. But the numbers they put in it were based on a lump sum. And then they told the client that they're billing on a percentage. Like, you got all three there. Which one? Like, I read the contract. You have inconsistent terms within the contract. And you say a percentage. So we had a conversation with them on the phone. I said, okay, I'm going to rewrite the even though I shouldn't have to, but because I wanted to make it clear for my client. So I rewrote the clause to make sure it understood. So this one, the first one, is if your client asks you, like, what are we doing on the cost of the work? So, are there any general accepted percentages? Like, when you're in your field, what's the percentage, what's the cost that they're normally going to charge? So, like, with a residential, is it residential, is it multi-unit, is it single family? Is it a commercial, office space, civic, industrial? Certain fields are going to have different costs. For example, office space, if you're going to have the percentage, it's going to be lower because there's a lot of it out there. It may be only, 4 or 5%. But if you're going to have a single-family home, that might be 6 or 7, or if it's high-end, it may be 10 or 12. And so you have to kind of understand what the product that you're putting out there, the design product, and where you can charge. And so there will likely be, if you're doing a percentage of the cost of the work, 4 different projects within your company, different rates you're going to charge. It's not always, we're always charging 4% or 8% or whatever it is. So you need to think about that first. The issue of the dollar curve, the money curve. So when you start working, you know, you're not going to have a lot of money in, but actually the beginning of the projects, whether it's design or construction, are going to be a lot more work because you're putting in a lot more time. Even though we talked about the percentages of 15% for schematics and 20%, 15 to 20 for design development, and then the 40 to 45% for the construction documents, that's your time frame, but you still have a lot of startup time and everything else. So can you get enough money in the curve? So how do you get more cash up front as opposed to this kind of smooth line? And so also when you think about it, you're like, well, wait a minute. I'm designing now. They haven't even started construction. So when do I get paid for my design service? Because if it's based on the cost of the work, well, the cost of the work hasn't even started yet. So part of the way you put together your analysis for the client is you say, we're going to see how much money they're going to be spending in cost, and then you bill against that, and it'll eventually catch up. So that's the next thing you want to think about in percentage of the cost of work. Is the client secure with fees, how the fees are being charged? What about the upfront curve? Do they understand that? Part of the thing about business that a lot of people, like, we're designers. We get out there, we love to make these cool designs, and the people hire us for that skill set. But it's as much of anything else as communicating to them how much things are going to cost. That's really important. I have, and I'm guilty of this, I have at times where I haven't been as clear with my client on the cost up front. And then when they get the bills, they're like, sticker shock. So it's a lot about communication. And so you want to make sure when you're talking to them and explaining this concept of the cost of work, hey, again, we're not even incurring any cost for the construction cost yet, but I'm going to be billing you because I'm designing you. So I'm billing it against what it's going to cost. And you have to figure those numbers out. And then on this one here, the ethical issues of cost runs over and under. Is the work performed equal to the fees billed? Like, what happens if you anticipate that there's going to be $100,000 worth of construction costs for a certain type of work, and your design team in the beginning that's billing against that $100,000 in that first couple of weeks or whatever it might be, first month, 2 months, whatever it might be, your design team only generates or has incurred costs of $50,000. Can you build against $50,000 worth of work? Can you build them against that? Can you bill more for the hours that are put in? Because ultimately what's going to happen is, while there's different percentages, you're all going to have an hourly rate, and that's how they calculate. Same with mine, we have an hourly rate. So if I work 8 hours at $100 an hour, that's $800 that I should bill. If you look at the cost of the work, the cost of construction for that 8 hours worth of work, maybe it's only worth $400. If I'm billing $800, but it's only worth $400 off the construction cost, am I dealing up front? And so everything will ultimately, it catches up, but that's going to be a question you have to kind of determine. And how do you handle that with the client? If they come in like, why is it so expensive? So again, and I'll show you a chart that we're going to, a chart will come up and show you how you can talk to them about how those dollars are handled on the percentage basis. And part of that was going on was what I was trying to explain or understand what this architect that I was negotiating the contract with, I didn't understand how it was written. I'm like, you seem like you're billing inconsistently with what your contract says. So it's about communication and making clarity. So, more thing on that. What is a construction cost? I mean, that's one of the big things that you want to explain to your client. The construction cost we had, if you remember, in 6.3 of the B101, defines the cost of the work. And the construction cost, that's why I have here construction cost or the construction cost, cost of the work or the construction cost. They're the same thing for purposes of what you're doing. And so, when the construction cost determined for calculating and invoicing fees, when payment is based on a percentage of these construction costs, that's this front-loading of you as the architect, whether you're doing the estimating or not, you're going to, before even the contractor shows up, you're going to be giving your client, here's what we think it's going to cost. And the client may need to see where the curve is, how much you're going to be spending when, so like a cash flow. Sometimes the client will want to get into that much information. Some don't. Some aren't that sophisticated. Some don't care. But a lot of times they'll want to see and say, okay, if I'm building this $10 million building, you as the architect are designing it for me, when am I going to need the money I need to pay the contractor those construction costs? And as you start to explain that, you'll be tying your fees to those percentages. So you need to understand. What will happen is you guys put together your schedule and your estimates and the cash flow, but then when the contractor comes involved, because they're the ones that are actually charging, they're going to be the ones that finalize all that stuff. And so you may, your estimates and everything, maybe not price the total $10 million, but maybe your cash flow will be a little bit off, and so you have to explain that to the client. Here's what I think the cash flow is going to be, but we get the general contractor, and it may change a little bit. So, also, do you do it at the time of the bid when the construction costs? So yes, at the time of the bid, you're going to do a cost, and that's what it's going to be. Or change orders. Well, wait a minute. I did my analysis on cost of the work, but now the client comes back and says, I have a three-bedroom, two-bath house. I want to make it a three-bedroom, three-bath house. The price goes up. Well, so because you're based on the percentage of the total cost, you need to figure out how you catch that up. Where's that catch-up going to come? It may come in when you're billing on the construction documents. It may come in your construction administration. But ultimately, make sure the client understands, we thought it was a $1 million house. Here was our percentage of 10%, so our fee was $100,000. Now you've gone to $1,000,001. Well, it's going to be $110,000. So they need to understand as the change orders come in. And then where do you bill for those increased fees? Again, part of it may be a catch-up. Part of it may be is because you're doing a percentage. You show the percentage, the cost, total cost of the work went from $1 million to $1.1. And so you're just billing against that percentage. You don't necessarily have to make it up from what was billed already, but it will make up as you're billing along as you get to the end. Okay? The percentage one is probably the most difficult to understand because it moves and flows. Interestingly enough, I find, well, depending on the project is whether you're going to use lump sum, percentage, or cost of work. But I will find that the most of the time, well, not most of the time, you're going to have an architect bill on the percentage of the cost of work more often than the other two, but there's almost an equal split, maybe like 40-30-30 or 45-25-25, whatever the numbers that need to be there for that, 27.5-27.5. But between the other two, which is hourly or lump sum. And the reason why is when you do a lump sum, you need to know your costs really well. Because if you say, I can do this house for you, a $1 million house for $100,000, well, you may not know the client. And they may not know how much activity or how much additional time you need to spend on it with the client. You know, the price stays the same. It's still $1 million, but they change from this, they want to change this, they want to change that. And all of a sudden you have a lot of modifications, but you're still stuck with this lump sum. So you have to know your product, what you're designing, and how well you can do that, and where your profit margins are. Because when you start, if you analyze, you thought, okay, I'm going to put 20 hours into this portion of the design project, and it costs you 30, well, now you potentially could be losing money because you can't change your price because it's a lump sum. But you have an extra 10 hours you have to figure out where you bill for. So it can be more risky, but what ends up happening also on the flip side is if you have a system in place, if you understand your business, if you understand the model that you're working on, hourly actually could be the most profitable because you can give them a price, and once they lock in, as long as you get the work done and you don't spend 20 hours, you spend 15, now you've made five hours worth of work, all pure profit. So it depends on how efficient you are. And then part of that is your overhead and profit margins. Your overhead is going to be your office and you know, the lights, the stamps, the paying of the associates, you know, people that are salaried and everything. So we'll get into costs and expense. So you have to understand those to be able to give an accurate assessment of your lump sum. And then how do you bill for increased fee when the construction cost goes up? So you have this $1 million house and you said, I'm going to do it for $100,000. What do you do when it goes up to $1,000,001? Did you calculate back behind when you were doing it that it was a 10% fee, but you don't tell the client that, you just say it's $100,000, that's my lump sum. So when it goes up by another $100,000, you just add a 10% and say, this is where it is. Do you say, or does the contract say, and this is where most contracts will do this, and it's in the B101 in Article 11, those would fall potentially as additional services. Remember, If your the services were going to be is architectural, civil, structural, structural, MEP, and electrical, if that's what you're going to be providing as a basic services, and then they want you to put that third bathroom on, well, you're just doing more of your basic services. So for that, you would charge for an hourly basis, because if you remember in the B101 in Article 11, it talks about additional services should be charged at an hourly rate, and you put your hourly chart in there. So that's a way that you can do that, but do you explain to the client? So you put in your contract, we're going to do all this for $100,000, but anything that you change is going to be an additional service, or if it's even different than basic, supplemental services, those are all going to bill hourly. That's the safest way to protect yourself. Some people will just say, oh, if you want to add that bathroom, it's going to be another $10,000 or whatever it might be. But it's the safest way is to do the hourly basis for that. Question?
Are there any other ritual forms that have part of the cost with construction companies, long-term to regulate do those estimates better in the front end to then better estimate cost for them gain more profit margin, or is that totally underscored not?
No, the answer to your question about whether there's architecture firms that pair up with construction firms to at the very minimum to be able to better estimate, yes. And in fact, we talked a little bit about design build last week, and the design build either is contractor led or architect led, and more often there's more architect design led design build companies now than there used to be. It's still predominantly construction contractor led. And so they'll join forces in the design build community because after I talked about the risk profile, and if you're doing the construction, you're going to make more money. So there'll be those connections to have architects to be more profitable. But at the same time, they will learn about that because every construction team, every construction contractor, general contractor, otherwise, have to have an estimator. That's the only way they can bid the job is that they have a cost estimator. They'll have a team of cost estimators depending on how big the firm is. And so if the architects can learn from that, there are also cost estimators that are just out there. And oftentimes the owner will hire their own cost estimator and architects will sometimes retain them. Like for a big project that I worked on a couple years ago, the design team had an in-house it was a big company. They were. I think they had 8 or 10 offices nationally. So it was a big engineering, design and engineering firm, architectural engineering firm. And they had their own internal cost estimating team. But because the facility they were designing was very so unique, they hired a specialist consultant just to do the cost estimating for our company, for our project. And they still blew the bid, and they had to do some redesign for free, but that was okay, because I wrote into the contract. It was if anything was 8% or higher, over 8% of the original estimate they gave us, if the bids came in over 8%, they had to redesign for free, and it came in at like 14%. And they were like, oh, you don't have to, you got to pay us. And I'm like, nope, it's clause right here. And there had been changes, we gave them a little bit of break because it was during COVID, so prices went up because of COVID, so we gave them a little bit of float on that, but still. So yes, architects will join, they will hire people, they will do that. And there's nothing unethical about that. So. And then obviously what's the scope change? That may be the reason why there's the change order or scope change. Like I said, you add the additional bathroom. How do you price those? And then additive change orders versus deductive change orders. So this is one thing that I won't say a lot of clients have some problems with this, but a few, it's hard for them to understand. So let's say that I'm designing for you and we figure out the construction cost of a 3-bedroom, 3-bath house, and you give them the cost estimate and it comes in at $600,000, and then they decide, you know what, we want to remove one of those bathrooms, we don't need it, so we're going to have a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house, and that knocks $50,000 off the price of the project. Well, they do that when you're well into the process. And so you've built your fee on the $600,000 house, and now it's worth $550,000. But you've already put in design services for that. The client says, well, your fee should come down, right? Because the cost of the work is $550,000 instead of $600,000. The answer to that is no. The reason why, well, I won't say always no, but if it happens very early on in the schematic design phase, maybe yes, yours will come down. But if you put a lot of time in and you've designed it for that, you're still going to have to do redesigning for that space that's gone. Is it just because, like, you know, it's not like it was a standalone bathroom sitting on a wing that you can just cut off in your design. Normally it's going to be integrated into the house. It's your circulation flow, your plumbing, your electrical, all that stuff that has to come into consideration. And so you will be required to still do the redesign fees. And so what happens is you want to explain in the contract that deductive change orders may not reduce your costs. Certainly on the design side. Now on the construction side, more often than not, the deductive change order will reduce costs because they're not buying anything and they're not building anything, but there still are administration fees, and that will cover that in the A201. But that's another thing is when you have these deductive change orders where they remove something, that's a conversation you need to explain to the client. Well, why am I being charged if it's going to be cheaper? The house is less expensive. Well, because I still have to redesign, and that would be done hourly. And it's faster to redesign to remove something and fill the space in than redesigning and building something in to make it aesthetically pleasing, but it still takes time. So, and then inflation. What do you do when things go up in the price? Like you have a price of cost of what you're going to be doing on a lump sum. Two things that happen. Inflation, one, is it fair? If the value of the project, if you've done your estimate and it's going to be the $600,000 house and the cost of materials and fuel and everything else goes up, and just by its own nature, the price of the house goes up to $700,000. I was working on a project 4 or 5 years ago. It was a home residential project, and well, it was during COVID, and so 5 or 6 years ago. And the price of lumber went through the roof, and so what you couldn't get it. 2x4 is just to frame out a house. So they had to go to using steel studs. And then do you use the 4-inch or the 6-inch? Well, the 4-inches also were unavailable because the first thing you went from a 2x4 to a 2x4 of a steel stud. So those weren't available. If they were more expensive. And so then we had to look at the 2x6s. Well, that changed then how big the room is. A 2x6 makes the room smaller. So we have to change all these things affected just because of the price of lumber. How do you bring that in? And it ultimately cost the client significantly more because it was a large project. Do you get to charge the cost of the work for that increase in the cost of the construction? And that can be a negotiation. I would say, if I'm advising you as your lawyer of your architect, yes. Because you may have gone through all the gymnastics that we just went through, from wood to metal, from 2x4 to 2x6. How do you figure that out? One of the things we had to do was actually working between our designer and our contractor. We had to have multiple bids out there to suppliers. And we ended up having to like just buy stuff when it was available on the market because things weren't just because of the supply chain and everything else. And so we weren't even sure if we would use it all. So those are all things that come into the discussion. And if the architect is doing more work, like our architect did, and redesigning and making sure the space was different, otherwise their value, even though the cost of the construction went up, they were able to charge that. If it's other things, maybe the client comes back and asks you for, I don't think I should have to pay that additional cost on an hourly basis or whatever. Why am I charging more if it's on this lump sum? Why do you get to increase it? So that's where this, maybe you say to them, well, I'm not going to increase from 100, like on the $1 million house to the 10%. I'm not going to go from 100,000 to 110. I'm doing the 100,000, and even though the price of the house has gone up, not because of changes in the design, but simply because of the cost of materials, I'll charge you the same 100,000, but if I have to do additional work, I will do that hourly. So it maybe ends up that I only charge you, instead of 100,000, I charge you 104 because I only have $4,000 in extra hourly work. So there's ways, again, to communicate to the client. Parts of this work won't be based on the cost of the work because you're not changing your scope. If you change your scope, that's different. But if you're not changing your scope, but I still have to do more time, more work related to it, calling up people to find out if the steel's available or whatever, I should get at least my hourly basis on that. And market price influence, that's kind of what we were just talking about there. So that's how you deal with lump sum. Hourly is pretty simple. But, and we talked a little bit about this, are there limits? Are there caps? We talked about the GMP contract that I said, you know, there's this guaranteed maximum price. And but when you're doing hourly, and that's all it is hourly, well, you can go forever. I had a project where it was a high-end residential project out of New York City, and the price that was set was that the architect's fee would never go more than 16%. And it didn't say never go more. It was an estimate that the architect's fee would be 16% of the cost of the work. And the project was between $8 and $10 million, and it stayed. It never got over $10 million, but it went because they were doing it at the very beginning. We thought it'd be about $8 to $10 million. It was a renovation of a brownstone, and so they didn't know what was behind the walls and everything else. And so they thought the construction cost. And the construction cost came in about $10 million when they found out what was in the guts. It always goes up, never goes down. But also the fees were going over 16%. So there was a discussion, and it went to 18%. And the client understood and had some discussions. And then it went to 20. And then it went to 22. And the client was like, well, this is ridiculous. Why is it going up? We're still at the 8 to 10 million. Why am I now at fees just because you're putting more hours? And the architect, and by the way, 20% for a design of a residential space is high end. That's but these architects they're really one of the best in the country. So they get that fee, maybe not 20% all the time, but they get the high percentages because they are so good and so attention to detail. And there was a big negotiation between the client and the architect, and it went for about 10 months. We never could get the stuff finalized in the contract. They were doing design, they were building the space and everything else. I'm like, we got to get this contract signed. I mean, a lot of times, and this here's a surprising thing you might not know, work will happen on projects, less so on the construction side, but on the design side, with contracts not being signed. And I always tell my architects, and in this case it was the owner I was representing, I'm like, get the contract signed, because if something goes south and you're trying to bill them, you can't breach the contract, isn't, because it's never signed. And they can say whatever they thought it meant. And so the 16, 18, 20, 22, it was he said, she said the whole time. And so we finally got the deal done, but the client was frustrated because there was no cap, no limit. And they worked it out. I think they worked out ultimately 18%. But that's a worry and a risk, both for you as your reputation as an architect and for the client on an hourly fee, because there's no end to it. And here, the argument was it was rewarding inefficiency. Now, I can't say whether it was inefficiency by the architect or not. I was not part of any of the design changes. I sit way back. I don't get into a lot of the money discussions. I do the legal side and tell them why you need to have things signed or otherwise. But there could be inefficiency. And so if you're going to be doing this on an hourly basis and people are like, oh, I built 8 hours today, and they spent time, you know, hanging down at their friend's desk, and they went out for a margarita or whatever, and they built 8 hours, maybe they didn't really get 8 hours worth of work. And I'm not saying architects do that, but sometimes that happens. You're just not efficient. I can tell you this. I work. Sometimes you guys have seen my emails at 1 o'clock in the morning because I'm trying to get an agreement out. I don't charge my client for that extra time because I'm just not efficient. I'm just too tired. I just stop my clock, but I got to get it out. So I do it for them, but I don't charge them for it because it's not there. So, and then finally, fixed rates versus current rates. So what happens is when you are working on a project, let's say it's going to be longer than a month or two, or maybe it goes and spans over the holidays from the New Year's. Do you say, for this project, I'm going to charge you $250 an hour for the entire project no matter when, knowing that it's a short term and that it won't really matter? Or do you put into the agreement that says our rates go up at the first of the year? And so you're charging $200 an hour this year, and it becomes January 1, and now it goes to $225 an hour, $220 an hour, whatever it might be. And the client's like, wait a minute, I mean, you knew this was only like going to be 2 months. So for 1 month, you're charging me $200, and the second month, you're charging me $225. Is that fair? Those are some of the things you want to think about. Sometimes clients will come back and say, I need you to lock in the rates for X number of months. But there is a clause in the B101 that talks about, and should be in all your contracts, that rates will go up at the first of the year, that you at least give them notice of that. And then you, part of one of the things I was negotiating in an agreement 2 nights ago was we had to put a provision that said, you will give us at least 30 days notice prior to your rates increasing. Even though we knew this was a long lead project, that was a long-term project, they were going to be designing for about a year and a half because it was a huge, huge project. We knew it was going to go up in January. We just want to see what those rates are. Maybe you can have a discussion. If it's everybody's going up by like 15%, maybe you come back and say, well, I know your rates are going up for that for this project. You're locked in. Maybe we go up only 10%. Some things that happen in the discussions. So, any questions on those? Okay, payment schedule. So first we have here is we have this chart that talks about where your percentage is, and I've used these a bunch of times. But we have your phase, schematic design, design development, construction documents, bidding and negotiation, and construction administration. So I've kind of thrown these numbers out, 15, 20, 40. This could be 10, this could be 15, this may be 50, up to 50. Whatever it is, I just try to do this pretty simple as far as how much time the percentage is when you start doing your budgeting. Because now you're going to be looking at it and saying, okay, I'm designing this $1 million house, I'm going to get 10%, so I got $100,000 in. Where do I want to do? And how much cost am I going to be figuring out? Where's my cash flow? Because I need to pay my people. Where's my cash flow coming in? This one we went higher. So this is a bigger building. So we said to the client, we said, we're going to design your space for $600,000, whatever the space is. Now, of that, we hire consultants, the electrical engineer, the structural engineer, the mechanical engineers. We hire those. And so roughly, you want to think about, and this is not, by the way, all the numbers that I'm putting out here are kind of from middle USA city. You know, like you're going to see some rates up here that are really low from what you would get much higher rates in Chicago, whatever. I did an analysis. It's been 3 or 4 years, so I probably have to go back and update it. But I did analysis shortly after COVID, and I looked at my numbers, and I found like median, middle of the country type concepts, and they're pretty close, but they're probably higher now. But so all this is kind of based on a generality. So, but you can think about when you're putting together your project, you're like, okay, roughly a third of what I think my costs are going to be done by the electrical engineer, the structural engineer, and mechanical engineer. Those are your consultants. Now, if they work for you, meaning they're in-house, you won't need to break it up like this. This model that I have up here is based on the concept that I'm hiring those consultants. So the amount of architectural fee we're generating is $400,000. Of the $600,000, we're going to generate about $400,000. And how do I figure out when I'm going to get paid? So this is, I take that $400,000 and I look at my percentages here, and I tell my client, this is based on a percentage of complete, and I tell my client, hey, we think that your project is a $6 million project, I'm going to get $600,000. That's going to be my fee, okay? And this is where we think how our percentages of that $600,000 is going to be broken up. Percentage, not ultimately it's the full cost of the work, but this we're not basing it on actual construction costs and the timing. This we're going to base it on the percentage cost of work of how much we're working. And this is probably the most common. So you say to the client, hey, we're going to take about 2 months to do schematic design. You're going to give them the schedule. And this will work as your schedule. You're going to say to them, 2 months, 2 months, 4 months, 1 month, 12 months. This is how long it's going to take to build your project. So you give them this very rudimentary schedule in the beginning. And you say, I'm going to work with you back and forth on schematic design. We're going to, you know, volumetric. We're going to get eventually, we're going to get some basic plans, some basic elevations, so you can get to see what it is, just as it's described in the B101. And that's roughly 15% of the $600,000, which comes to $60,000. And if it's going to be 2 months, I'm going to just send you a bill each month for $30,000. Now, I may not spend as much the first month on my hourly rate. So if we tried to calculate this based on hours, the first month I bill $30,000, maybe I only spent like $22,000 in hourly charges. But it's easier for the client to understand when they see this. They say 15% of the $400,000 is a $60,000 fee, and I'm going to bill you on 2 months. When you get to design development, that value is 80% because it's going to be up 20 or 80,000 because it's 20%, and you bill that each month. You bill $40,000. So this gives the client what I call the cash flow. For 2 months, they're going to pay 30. For 2 months, they're going to pay 40. For 4 months, they're going to pay 40 for the design construction document. Bidding, it's going to be, you know, bidding and negotiation, sending out the RFP, looking at the contractor's bids and stuff. That's going to be $20,000. And then here, you're not getting all that much. You actually get less money at the end because you're only spending about 20% of the time, the total time on your project. And that's going to be for 12 months, they're going to pay you just over $650,000 or $6,500, you know, 6666. So, this helps you in figuring out your cash flow. This helps you in making sure that your team is working within these periods. You know, let's say you have a small project or a new project and you have younger architects in. You give them, you have to have all this done within this period of time. That way you can balance your own inefficiencies. You make sure that your own team stays within this. Because if all of a sudden these things increase, then you're losing money because this doesn't change and this doesn't change. So this is something both internally and externally that you can use. So, that makes sense. All right. So how do we then manage that? So we have at any firm, you're going to have costs and expenses. So we have, first, this side is costs, and this side is expenses. And it's just for the accounting purposes. And like I say, I'm not the accounting person, so this is, again, really, really rudimentary, very, very high level, and I'm sure that anybody that's a CFO or anybody that knows accounting will be like, you're just like, you've dumbed it down too much. But I just want to, we're not here for math, we're here just to kind of understand. So, on your costs, when you're looking at your costs, these are something that generally here we put it in the payroll. That's a cost that the company's going to incur. So these are random, not random, but these are salaries based on Middletown, USA, 4 or 5 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, whatever it was. The principal's going to make $175,000 a year. Now this, by the way, this also includes like, you know, this is just a straight salary. Because your expenses over here will, I'll explain when I get over there. But this is just their straight salary, okay? So you got a principal that's making $175,000, two associates at $75,000 each, a senior architect, junior architects, et cetera, et cetera. And so your costs, oh, here's the health insurance. That's what I was going to say. Your health insurance, because everybody gets health insurance, and so you're paying premiums on behalf of that. You know, some people, like at my firm, I pay, because I'm a partner, I pay all of my premiums because I'm ownership. But if you're an employee, that's just one of the benefits you get. So the firm pays for that. So for here, I just put in the number of 100,000. It's probably like woefully low now where we're looking at insurance costs. But this would cover not the principal, because the principal is an owner, but it would cover these people here, the associates, juniors, senior associates. Some firms, the associates may have an ownership interest. It just depends on how they're put together. But certainly it would cover all these people here. And then on the other side, a secretary, receptionist, and other ones. That's your health insurance. So your costs for this model that we put out here is $750,000. Okay. Now, how do you make money at a firm? Well, generating revenue is time on the boards, time on the computer. So you are an hourly rate. So this is going to be based on an hourly concept. So you want to see if you can bill 40 hours a week for 50 weeks, because you only give people 2 week vacation or whatever like that. Here's the other thing. To bill 8 hours, you got to work 10, because in that 8 hours, you're going to go to lunch, and you're going to be walking down the hallway, you're going to be talking to people and everything else, and sometimes it's maybe 11 or 12 to get that 8 hours. So, if these people are working 10 hours a day, 50 weeks, you have 8 people, 2, 4, 6, 8, you have 8 people, you want them to do 2,000 hours a year. Let's just say that's the number you use to try to figure it out. So you have 16,000 hours of billable time that you can bill out to the clients. So you have, this is just to cover your costs only. There's no profit in this. There's no research and development. There's no marketing. This is just pure cost. So to do that, that $750,000 worth of cost, you divide it by 16,000 hours, you need to make at least $44.69 an hour when you bill out. Now, of course, if a client saw that I've got a bill for $50 an hour for an architect, that would be like huge. I'd sign up in a second. Well, obviously that's not the end of the equation, because that's just cost side, and that's just for you to make costs. So we have the expense side. On the expense side, you're going to have a secretary, a receptionist. This is a small little 8-person firm. Somebody answering the phone, somebody handling, you know, just one secretary, one receptionist. You've got your rent. Professional liability insurance in case you get sued. You don't want to make sure you get sued, so that's your premium for that. Other insurance, that may be car insurance. It may be your commercial general liability in case someone comes and trips as they're walking over your doorstep or whatever. Printing, phone, these are all just like expenses. So that's why it's on this side. So you add that up. Legal, you got to pay me. So I always put myself in there. Accountant, miscellaneous, this may be marketing, this may be other stuff, you're not sure what that might be. So we have $380,000 in this model of expenses. And so to do that, we do the same calculation here for your expenses, so you need to generate $23.75 an hour. So that's just to cover your expenses. So what would make sense here is to cover costs and expenses, again, with no profit, no ability to grow, nothing else, just simply to survive. You add those two together, and you get $68.44 an hour. So just about $70 an hour on an average, because the principal is going to charge higher than a beginner, but that's your average. Just to make costs and expenses, you get no profit in that, nothing else. So at a minimum, you're going to be setting bills where the average hourly rate is $70 an hour. That's the first part of how to do costs and expenses. Make sense? Okay. So, now you got to make a profit. Well, I have built into this equation roughly 20% profit. Now, you may think that's huge, that's great. Well, it goes pretty quickly if you think about it, because every one of those people that have worked 2,000 hours, and the receptionist, and the secretary, and everything else, they want their Christmas bonus. So that's coming out of your profit. It comes out of you as your own individual profit. So 20% actually isn't a big profit. Like, in my firm, if I'm not mistaken, their profit margin that they try to make off the hourly is somewhere, it's in excess of 30%. Because you have to take into all the factors that come in. Because profit also can go for, again, more marketing, research and development. I know, like, in our firm, if we hire a new attorney, there's going to be a fee if we use a recruiter. So the recruiter sometimes will charge the value of 1 year's salary of the person they place, which is could be really big. So they have to factor all that into the profit. So here we take the 68.44, which is your cover your cost expenses, multiply times 0.2 for your 20%, so you need to get another $13.69. So when you add those two together to make 20% profit, which is just teeny if you really think about it, you're roughly going to be charging average $85 an hour to your client. That means the principal is going to charge $150, the beginner is going to charge $40, wherever it is, how you math and how many hours are going to be what. And what's going to happen, and this happens in any project that you're going to work on, and happens in my business because we're an hourly-based business, is the client's going to hire you because of the senior designer. And they're going to want all the brain power and the capabilities and the experience and the creativity of the senior designer. And they're going to say, but I want it to be done all by the junior people because they're cheaper. So their costs, so the owner, the client's costs stay down. But the big guy has to get in, the big person, whatever, the big designer has to come in because they have to make the decisions. They can't pass it all off. So that's part of your balance. And I'm not even getting remotely into that, how you balance out between the percentage of hours for the senior designer versus the middle associate and the junior. That's beyond me. But your average is $85 an hour. Okay? So now, that's what you're going to say. You're like, okay, I put my bills, my business together. I'm going to charge $85 an hour. Can I sustain operations based on that? Can I be a successful operating architecture firm doing that? So, here's my calculation. Production cost, overhead, so my costs and expenses is $1,095 divided by 12 months. So I need to generate, this is just how much money you have to bring in every month to cover your bills. Sometimes it's going to be more, sometimes it's going to be less, because sometimes your expenses when you pay, a lot of times like in January, you're going to pay all of your insurance costs. You're going to pay all your professional liability costs. So like January and February are huge months. And then, so months, some your expenses and cost expenses go up and down depending on the month. This is, again, very basic. In order to cover my costs and expenses without any profit, I need to bring in people paying me $91,250 a month. So just under $100,000 a month, I got to get paid. If you think about it also, you do work in January, you send your bill in February, they don't pay you till March. So part of your money coming in is also delayed. But that's the first analysis. To cover solely my costs and expenses, I got to bring in $91,000 and some odd change every single month. To do profit, we add that 20% in. Now I got to generate roughly $110,000 a month, $109,500. So roughly $110,000 a month, I got to bring in the into the business. And this is only for the architectural portion of it. Remember, there's that one third on top of that, that your consultants, and your consultants are going to be charging you and they're going to be wanting to get paid. So that, even in my model, I don't have any of that. That's going to be an expense of paying them every month. You have to pay them every single month too. So that number of $110,000 is going to go up by another third, so another $30,000. So you're going to be bringing in $140,000 to $150,000 a month to cover your costs and expenses with a profit, paying your consultants. Making sense? Okay. I don't know why this is here. I tried to get rid of it. Okay. So, to generate $1.3 million, that's your fees, for just architectural fees, because I've taken the consultants out because it's just, again, it gets too complicated when we do this analysis. The projects will also require this is your consultant. This is your 30. I put 35% of, the other slide was 35% here. So what your fees need to generate here is the $1.3 million plus the $700,000 for the fees at 35%. Total fees generated. So you're going to generate $2,021,500 of fees per year. So you're going to be sending out bills. So that's another way to look at it. And kind of what I'm doing here with these various slides is to kind of give you a different perspective, different ways of looking how money goes in and money goes out. So, if the average fee an architect charges is 4% of the construction cost, then for $2 million in fees and revenue, that's $50 million of construction volume a year in order to sustain an office of this size. Now, we live in Chicago, we have big projects. So you can have a $50 million project or two or three or four $10 million projects. You know, I've talked about those in examples and things like that. So to get you in a big city, $50 million worth of construction costs may not be that big a deal. So if you have a small office and you're here, you may be able to get that. But your expenses are going to be higher. Your salaries are going to be higher. So these numbers will all go up. But for Milltown, USA, small little town that the guys are doing, you know, $200,000 houses or small things, you know, it may not be that easy to get $50 million worth of buildings every single year for a tiny little office of 8 people plus 2 assistants, so 10 people total, with relatively inexpensive rates. I mean, that's a lot of money. So what we have here, that's your 4% is the fee. So if you have $50 million times the fee, it gets you to that $2 million. So it gets you, so you can work it backwards. Multiply this and you get to your $50 million. So think about that. When you go to, and I'm not trying to scare anybody from hanging a shingle. A lot of people want to do this and people ultimately do it. And I think that's the reason why I want to show you this. Is when you go and go out there, what I recommend, and I've actually some of my students from a long time ago, since I've been doing this 14 years, have called me and they're like, well, I'm at this point where I wanted to go out and hang my own shingle. And I'm like, the first thing you need to do, not call me, but thanks for calling me, is to get somebody that knows how to open a business and somebody that understands what your costs and expenses are going to be. I told this individual, I told her, I said, look, I gave you some slides 12 years ago, wherever it was, and I said they're really basic and rudimentary. There's a lot more in there, but at the very least, start to try to look at it. If you're going to open a shop, how many people, how much money you have to generate, what do you really think you can do that, what's your book of business really going to look like. So something to think about. Again, not to scare you away, it's just to open your eyes. Different way to look at it. This was the one that always kind of blows me away. If you need to generate just over $2 million in fees, that means you have to collect just over $168,000 a month coming in every single month, or just under $39,000 a week, or almost $8,000 a day. $8,000 a day, every single day, every single day, every single day, every single day. That's without weekends. It's only 260 days. But it's something to think about. Again, how much money do you need to generate? And, you know, if you're charging $85 an hour, well, that's $100 worth of work. So, you know, you can do that. But you have to think about where those costs are going to go. Yeah? Yes, most often you should have an outside accountant. Remember on that slide it had accountant fee? So you're going to have an outside accountant that's going to help you, maybe depending on certainly opening up the business and giving you some models of where it's going to be. But what you'll find is small firms, whether it's a small law firm, small accounting firm, or small architectural firm, that principal is going to spend 60% of their time on business stuff, or maybe more. Much less time on the boards because it just takes all this time to figure these things out and to make sure the numbers are being right. They may have, because I had a secretary and a receptionist, so the receptionist is the person in the front door, one of those individuals may wear both hats and are dealing with helping you with the books. But a lot of time it's because the principal, part of the time if you're a principal and you're the owner, you're not ready to give to your beginner associate or beginner designer the keys to the kingdom to see what all the books are, you know. So it just depends on how you think about that. A couple of my friends, really good friends of mine, they were at two different firms and they left both firms and joined and made their own law firm. And one of the problems was is one of the two lawyers never did anything for business and the other one was doing all of it. And he was still had a full book of work, so he was working 16 hours a day, and the other guy was working 9-hour days, and it became a problem. They ultimately split because it just wasn't a fair balance. They were partners; they had two associates that worked for him, but they needed to have an equal weight of running the business. So but it's going to be normally the owners that are going to be doing most of this stuff. So, and as you get bigger, then you bring in your accounting department and everything else. But for a smaller shop, you don't have the margins. Because all these things go up because your costs and expenses go up. This goes from 1.3 million to 1.6 million, 1.8 million. Now you got to generate $62 million for the business a year. So, it's again, I don't put this up here to dissuade anybody from opening a business. I think actually when you get there, like my uncle was an accountant and he worked for a big firm and then he started his own firm and did fabulously. Like I said, the two guys ultimately they split and they are running their own firms. They're both doing very well. Like ultimately, you can do this and you can make more money if that's what you're interested in running your own shop than kind of being stuck with the system of what the firms you're in. But so there are many many benefits and the freedom of making your own decisions and taking your own vacations and all these other things are stuff that is really nice about running your own business. I mean that's what. You know, the small businessman is—it's a great thing to do, but it's just something. I just want you guys to think about these things when they come up. So, any questions on that? I'll figure out how to get that thing off the slide. Okay, production costs. So this is how we do the production costs. So now we got a project. This is like a real project that will theoretically real project, but we'll use it to show how you charge based on the costs. Okay. So we have a project here that's a $12 million in construction costs. So like a small strip mall or something. And you quote a design fee based on 4% of the cost of the work. Remember, you were out there in the market and you were looking at it and you were saying, okay, this isn't a high-end residential, this isn't a hospital, this isn't an office, so I got to look to see what the market will bear for architectural fees. And what you're hearing is 4, 5, 6%, you want to win the bid, so you say, I can do it for 4% of the cost of work. You're the, you're, you'd be efficient. you can get this done. So you go to the client, prospective client, and say, after you, before you've done the design, before you've done the analysis we're going to go through here, you say, I'm going to do this project for you at 4% of the cost, construction costs. And the client's like, okay. Now you go back and you run it. Okay, if I have an architectural fee at 4%, this is just the architecture fee. So that's going to be $480,000 of the $12 million. Structural engineer at 12.5%. So you got to take, this is your full thing, but you're going to take away from your fee. This is how much you would generate, the 480. So you're going to generate all 480. For your structural engineer, you got to pay them of what you've brought in, roughly 12.5% of that. Because if you take your 12.5% and your 22%, that gets you to about 1/3. Okay? So these are your two consultants, 12.5% and 12.7%. So you're going to take from the 480, you got to pay them, pay your the structural engineer $60,000. And then for your mechanical and electrical engineer, they may be a single entity or maybe a couple entities, you got to pay them $105,000. So we've now subtracted that from your revenue you've generated at 4%. And then you have a spec writer, somebody that, and now spec writers, even though you're like, what a specification writer is people that are, you'll hire them, either, sometimes you have them in staff, a lot of your specs, your specifications you already have kind of in your system, in your computer, because you've done it. Like, if you're going to do an end dam, this is how you do it. So it's all the written part that goes into a construction project of instructions of how to do it. You have your design work, and then all the specifications you've written. Like, if we're going to do painting, you need to prepare the walls twice with flat, and then you do this. Or if you're going to be doing installation of floors and how to do that, there's all this written stuff. They're called specifications of how to build your project. There may be some stuff that is a little more unique or different. So you have a spec writer. These people specifically go out, they look at a product, and they write out the specification of how that product that you're installing in, these light fixtures, these plumbing systems, whatever it might be, and they put that into your specification. So you have to pay a spec writer. So I just put $4,000. And then coordination. Somebody has to have a coordination of all the engineers. Coordination, the concept of what's called coordination is both, everybody has to be together at the same time. Who's going to be designing when to make sure they're meeting your schedule. That's part of it, scheduling coordination. The other is, and I talked a little bit about this, so if you look up here, we have this big giant silver duct work for the HVAC. Let's say that this was not going to be exposed and you can't see it, and there's a soffit in there, and it's a very small place, and it's within drywall. It won't be seen, like it's if it's a nice house, you're not going to have this exposed. Well, you got to make sure if it's only room for this ductwork here that they're not going to put in the other pipes. They're not going to run electrical conduit and all these other things. Somebody has to physically make sure when you lay the different drawings, architectural, structural, mechanical, electrical on top of each other, that they're not interfering. That's another part of coordination in the industry. So somebody has to pay for that. So again, we're going to talk about that. That's like another 10% taken off. And so we've subtracted here. That's not 10% though. My math is off. I'm sorry. But anyway, this should be... Oh, it's 10% of the engineer's fee. Sorry. You add these together. You add this together, 10% of that is 65. So it is right. My math is right. Sorry about that. So these are all subtracted from your fee coming in. And then, remember, you wanted to make a profit. So you have to get 20% profit. So 20% of the 480 is 96,000. So this is how much you have to produce the job. This means that once they pay you 480, you got to make sure that the work you get done based on an hourly basis can be performed for $198,000 or less based on how much you're paying your workers, their hourly rates. So can we do that? Well, remember, this is cost and expenses. This doesn't include your profit, because we already took profit out. Once we take the profit out, we don't have to go to the 85. We're just going to be making sure, so because this is just pure cost and expenses. So if you're going to get $198,000 of revenue to cover your cost and expenses, you divide it by your hourly rate for those costs and expenses. So that means you have to be able to do this job in 2,893 hours or less. You're billing people. Making sense? So can we do this? Well, here's our chart again. Schematic design. You're going to have one person, 8 weeks, because of what your time frame is for this project. They're going to work for 8 weeks, 40 hours a week. That's 320 hours that one person is going to work on schematic design. Design development, now you're going to have two people. So that's 8 weeks of $40 an hour. So the two people together, that's 640 hours. And then we go through construction document. Now you have 19,020 hours for all the time for the three people working on it. One person working on your bidding and negotiation for 4 weeks. And then I have a third of the person here because the construction person is not going to be there the whole time. They're going to be on the project site once a week. They're going to be handling phone calls. They're going to be dealing with RFIs and everything else, but it's not going to be their full day. So on this concept. So when you add up all this time, you're going to be spending 4,600 hours to do this $12 million project. But your budget only allowed 2,893. You're 1,700 hours over budget by charging 4%. Is this making sense how the math works? Like I said, I'm not going to have you guys do anything like this on the exam. I just want you to understand the concepts of how we get to these numbers. And so that means that you're going to have, if you take your 1,700 hours of over that you over budget, multiply it times your cost of expenses, that means you've lost $116,000 on this project. So you had a $480,000 fee, and after everything's spent, you're losing almost $170,000 on that project. That's not a good model. So what do? Well, we run this type of system, this pro forma, this analysis, before you go to the client and say, I can do it for 4%. And you'll have your models in there. That's where, when one of the slides earlier is know your business model, know how much time it's going to take. And that's why it's hard to go out in the very beginning on your own to hang your shingle, because you know how much time things take. I mean, even me today, like, I've been doing certain contracts for 3 decades, and I still am like, I totally told the client that it would take less hours than I would, because you always think you're faster than you are and some of those things. So, but this is something you'll do before you go to the client and say, I can do it. So what do? Well, you increase your fee. Instead of 6%, instead of 4%, let's go to 4.75%. Same analysis here. So we have 6.75 times the 12 million gets you $810,000. Now, when you do a model like this, these numbers also go up. If you remember, this $101,000 number was 60, and this 178 was 105, if you look on the previous slide. These numbers will go up because conceptually they'll all be pricing up. So when you do a model like this, you have to have everything equal based on the increase in percentages and based on the fee that you're generating. So if you keep these down low, it may not be. So you want to model these after the fee you generate. It's 12.5 of this. It's 22 of this instead of the 600,000 or 480,000 that you had on the previous slide. And you go through all the numbers down here, everything that we brought in before, and then you have your profit. Now to produce this job, you have $326,132. So now you have, before you had what do we have before the other one was? Hold on, let me see what we had on the other one. So 198. So that 198 has increased now to 326. So significantly more money to budget against that. So we put that and we calculate this and we put this now. These numbers will stay the same because the design isn't changing and your hourly rate isn't changing. So what you're going to bill, the number of hours, this chart will remain the same. Well, the previous chart, all the numbers went up based on the $810,000 fee. The amount of time spent remains the same, so you do your calculation. And when you add this all up, 4,600 hours required, you budgeted 4,765. You took that 362 and you did the division against the 68,000. So now here, you have excess. So here you have an $11,000 cushion. So that actually, you make it. You can do this project for 6.75%. You can do this for 6.75%. And you have this cushion. The good thing is we already built in the previous slide, we already built in the profit. So this is in addition to your 20% profit. But if you remember, I was telling you that 20% profit is really small for a business that's going to be operational. You want to look at profit 30, 40%, maybe even higher if you can, because you never know what's going to come up. You know, what happens if there's an accident, your insurance premiums go up? What happens if when the rent goes up? What happens if there's lots of what ifs that isn't built into this very simple model of mine? So you do have a little $11,000 cushion off of your $810,000 fee. And the question is, well, maybe, this should have been on the previous slide, I'm sorry. Must have got backwards. This is how we got the 4,765 hours budgeted against the 4,600. So you got that correct. So is that enough cushion? 165 hours? Maybe not. What happens if you have a client that wants to do a lot of changes, maybe not necessarily changes in the cost of the project, but they call a lot. They're a needy client. That 165 hours over a year and a half, 2 years, maybe you have to go to the project site a few more times than you thought. That's not a big cushion. Also, what happens when the client says, I think you charged me too much, and they want to negotiate your fee down? That always happens. Maybe not always. But there are plenty of clients that call me and say, I need you to reduce your fee. You're just too expensive. So you only have this 165 hours, $11,000. I mean, that could go away in one bill, one invoice. They could ask for a $10,000 invoice. So you may need to cut hours. Maybe the time that your associate or maybe that you're working on it weren't efficient. As I said, if I start working late for a client and then I have to get it out, and I need to it needs to be in their hands because they've asked for it and that's what the timing requires. But I'm less efficient, I can't build that. I don't, at least. I'm sure maybe other people do, but I don't because I don't think that's fair. So now you're burning of that 165 hours, like if I'm working from midnight to 1, there goes an hour. Maybe it's over 10 months, who knows how many hours go away. So that's something else to think about. Or when I'm looking at a bill and I see that one of my associates spend too many hours on a project that it should have been 5 hours and they spent 9. Well, maybe they're new, so I give them 7, but I still eat 2 hours of that. So those are things that all come into your running of a business. So maybe that 6.75, maybe that's not enough. So maybe you try 7% or 7.5%, and we're not going to do that model again. But that's something, again, that when you think about it, when you do your model, you look at the size of the project, the length of the project, and your cushion. Granted, you're still going to have profit in that, but your goal in running a business is not to eat into your profit. Your goal is to have, I always need to get 20%, and I want to get more so I can make sure that the what-ifs are taken care of. So, does this make sense? Okay. Can you scale back in hours in your initial budget? You know, these are some other things. How do you deal with that? And part of this is if you're going to go up to 7 or 7.5%, will the market support that? And as you become better at stuff, you become more efficient. And so that's where you can have some flexibility. Maybe that 4,600 hours that you built into this model after you've done this type of project 7, 8, 15 times, now you can do it for 3,800. You still use the model of 4,600 to do your calculations, but for every hour that you're efficient in coming in, the more cushion you get. So, questions? All right. Marketing and fees, where are we in time? Oh, we're good on time. Okay. Now we're going to get away from the math and just kind of talk about stuff. So, how do you get fees? How do you get your name out? What do you do to become you know, somebody wants to hire you. So we have marketing and selling, which are two different things. So what you want to look into it is, for marketing and selling, is do they know you? Do they know your work? Or were you recommended? Those are three ways that you can get your name out there and how you have your business. Now, selling of your business, maybe you're the one that's making those cold calls. You're selling yourself. Marketing, maybe sending out advertisement or have you other ways. Writing an article, winning an award. I got a call earlier this week. This woman who is a writer, she's written for the New York Times, a couple other newspapers, and she had just done a renovation of her house, and she put her in an email. She goes, luckily it went smoothly, but she said, I started wondering, because she had heard about some stories of horrendous like home residential projects, and she knew maybe from these lectures, I don't know, but she reached out and she said, would you mind having an interview? I'm like, yeah, if, I don't even know where the article is going to appear, where it'll appear, but if it's something that is interesting that she goes out and puts out there, that's a way to market myself out there. I'm not selling myself. It's a marketing concept. Selling myself is when I had that opportunity. I had a client, somebody called me, a prospective client, and said, I've heard about you. I need you to represent me in this project and tell me about what you do. Well, then I have to sell myself of what I do, and then I send them a proposal. That's part of the selling side. So, but here, the things you want to think about when you're getting out there is do they know you? So, how do they know you? Well, one of the things you want to do is widen your circle of acquaintances. And all this is really basic. None of this stuff is like rocket science here. But it's part of what I like to just kind of cover in the course and just kind of give you some ideas and thoughts out there. Become active in organizations. You know, like I'm part of the American Bar Association and I'm part of the Chicago Bar Association and I sit on committees. So I'm out there and like I if I can do speeches or whatever, be written up in articles, journals, trade magazines and things like that if you get that chance. What you're going to find, I've never practiced as an architect. I went to architect school. I got my degree in that. I've represented architects for years and stuff. So I can't say this 100%, but the amount of opportunities to write an article in the legal profession is like it never ends. There are so many people that are dying for people to write articles. I got to imagine the same stuff is available for you. The way you can go out there. There's trade magazines, there's all different types of things that you guys, and I don't do it very often because I got my own practice, but it's not like it's difficult to find a way to get your name out there in writing an article. And you could be on, you know, whether it's a project you worked on, whether it's a growing trend in the industry. You know, I got a call back in, I don't know if it was October or November, and the AA out of St. Louis. I did a lecture in January on AI and architecture and law and how AI is going to come in. And so I went and did a lot of research. We met with them. I put together an outline. I did a PowerPoint presentation for about an hour. So there's lots of opportunities. I know that stuff is available for you guys. Because my co-speakers, there was three people on the panel, they were designers. So there's lots of stuff here for people to get to know you. And you can do that right away. In fact, what will happen is when you get out, if you find something that's interesting to you and you start to focus on it a little bit of your extra time, I mean, none of us ever really have any extra time, but just do a little bit where you say, I want to look at this area of architecture. You know, maybe it's urban design, maybe it's AI, maybe it's whatever it is that you find that you can find a niche to and throw out a couple articles. Not only will that people get to know you, but in your firm, they're going to get to know you. And the next thing that happens is, because like one of the things I do is procurement. I do the RFPs, and I've done a lot for governmental agencies and for private organizations. I also represent a lot of high net worth people on homes. That's what I'm known for within the firm. So when there's a high net project for a high net worth client for a project, they come to me because they know that's what I do. So within your firm, if you start to, with other company work, if you start to do these articles or what have you, they will come to know that and you will be the go-to person. So that makes you valuable to them. That makes you help rise in the ranks and it'll get your name out there more to generate business. Here's the difference between marketing and selling that I have here. In the beginning, you're taking any job, like whatever I can take, and you're not really marketing or selling anything because you don't really have any experience. I mean, some people work in summers, but I was a baby lawyer a long time ago. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. You know, you just don't know. It just takes a while. It's a practice of architecture, a practice of law, because you keep practicing, getting better. But maybe you enter competitions for recognition, increase your professional activities, the AAA, teaching. I do this. You know, I've gotten clients because I do this and my lectures are out there. And I love teaching. Publicize whatever you have, you know, presentations, press, whatever you want to do. Those are different ways of going out and selling yourself, you individually, which is a little different than the marketing of what your skill set are. So, questions on that? All right? Here we have, and things like that, we have cold calls, networking, conventions, professional press, RFQ, RFPs. That's your marketing of what we can do, all this stuff. Here's what we can do, here's what we can do, here's what we can do. Selling is, I'm telling you, like I said, when the client called me and said, can you help me with this project and tell me why you can do that, you're selling yourself. They've come to you because they've marketed. Cold calls could also go into the selling side because you're actually talking to somebody individual, but you want to think about in the selling side is how you communicate what you can offer to them as opposed to for this very project, for this individual thing. So the marketing is a more generalized thing that you don't necessarily... You can have targeted audiences, but it's putting yourself out there like in an article, putting yourself out there in a presentation so they get to hear about you, maybe not as directly as you contacting them. Now, you get the client, what fee do we charge? Well, that's what we all kind of went through in those earlier analysis. And how do you get that client to sign the agreement? Well, that's part of that discussion of what you're going to providing to them. So that's part also of your marketing. Like right now, I have a bid out for a project. It's not a complicated project. It's a simple one. I gave them, instead of an hourly rate, I said, we will do it between this dollar and this dollar. So I gave them a range. How I figured out that range was I was like, I'm going to spend X number of hours on it, and I'm going to have an associate spend X number of hours on it, and hopefully we can get it done within those number of hours. So that's what my bid was to them. I'm waiting to hear back from that. So they haven't signed on to be being their attorney. What do I have to do? Well, it's been a couple days, so I'm going to drop them an email. I told you guys, last week, that I pitched Terrible for 10 months before I finally got their work. That was me both selling and marketing. Like when I first sent the RFP, that was marketing what we as the firm could do for them and what I as a lawyer, here's that marketing piece. That's my response to their RFP. And then I would call them and I would have a meeting with them and then I would say, can I do this for you for free? Can I look at your contract and I'll mark it up? You can get to see what I can do for you. And that's selling yourself and selling your product. And that's what ultimately, when I finally got the call, and they said they were going to hire me, it was 10 months later, that's what I got them to sign the agreement, which was nice. So, do you have a question?
I don't know if it was, but is marketing fees a part of your cost and expenses?
So it'll fall within the expense side in some ways, because for marketing, you may have to put together flyers and programs, informationals, what you put out there, advertisement, whatever that might be, of however you get your name out there. It's not going to be a cost, but yeah, it will be factored into your performance. It's not going to be a cost because you're always going to be paid. You're based on my model. There's other costs in there, but the costs are always going to be these costs. You know, the salary, the insurance, those are always going to be there. But marketing, if you want to think about what ends up happening and what's not in that pro forma is, so I get called up. I speak at different groups like the AAA that I do often, you know, three or four, maybe five or six times a year. And sometimes they I get sometimes I get paid for it, sometimes I don't, depending on what the organization is, depending on what the deal is or whatever else like that. For every one of these, I spend a number of hours putting together my presentation. That's not billable hours to the firm. That, if I'm getting paid, has to be built into whatever they're going to pay me to speak, but it never costs that. It never comes in. I never make a profit on it. If I had to live on my speaking, I would be dead. And even for this, the amount of hours that I spend, like I spend a lot of hours during the week working on stuff and updating my PowerPoints and things like that. All of those are, if you're looking at purely the economic model of running a business, are lost hours. They're not revenue generating hours. But it's me spending an hour that I could spend an hour making money. So yeah, those costs, they're not written on my performa. That performa sheet had a marking line item for like $20,000, I think it did. And that's for your hard costs of buying your business cards and buying advertising and paying your web browser fee and all those things that factor into that. It does not show anywhere in that performa lost revenue generated but lost because of time. So yeah, that's where when you start to look at the 20% profit, every hour that you spend where you're not generating revenue eats into that 20% profit because I'm still getting paid. So yes, it's all part of that analysis. That's why, and I'm never going to go there because I'm not the accountant person, but that has to be factored into your model. So like for a firm of 8 people with 2, like an assistant and a receptionist, that performer would probably have 25 more lines on different sides of what their costs and expenses are. But it's not worth it for the class, and I wouldn't know what I'm doing on it anyway. So, okay, anything on this? Good. Or anything more? Thank you. That was a good question. Okay, last couple slides. So, we want them to get them to sign the contract. So, what are the terms of the deal? So, what is included and what is not included in your fee? And when is the fee being paid? So you have to tell them, that's that chart, well, we're going to do schematic, we're going to do design development, we're going to do construction documents. Do you need me to do the bidding and negotiation, or do you have a contractor you want to do? Sometimes they're going to say, we don't have a contractor, but we're going to have our lawyer do the bidding because the lawyer does procurement and he's going to help with that. But you're going to have to work with them. So what's included? I've had clients also that say, well, we want to have you for the design side, but we're not going to have you walking the field. We have an owner's rep, so you're not going to be there for the construction administration phase, that last 20%. So you start to think about what's in that for the fee, what are you all getting, you have to explain that to them, and then when does the fee paid? If you remember, it showed that other chart that showed, you know, you have for 2 months it's at 30, 2 months at 40, 4 months at 40, so you can give them this cash flow so they understand. What's the charge for reimbursable expenses? So when I have FedEx costs, when I go and fly to a place to look at something, you know, whatever those additional reimbursable expenses that you have, do you charge them the actual cost? My recommendation is try to get 10 or 15%. 10% is a business average. Because if you think about it, so I have a cab. Maybe I take them out for dinner. I have to pay for my clients if they have to fly to look at a certain type of stone, or they have mileage. You know, if they're driving to a site back and forth, they charge me for mileage. All those things, you know, sending a FedEx, printing costs, all those things are expenses and reimbursable. If you're paying for them out of your business credit card, which is how you're going to pay, you carry that cost for at least 2 months, because you incur it in January, you bill them at the end of January. They have all of February, and they don't pay you until March. So now you have 2 months of carrying $1,000 of expenses, so you bill them. If you only bill them $1,000, you've now lost money because you're paying 12% or 8% or 13%, whatever it is on your credit card, or however you pay your expenses. So, reimbursable, try to get 10%. So the cost of the actual cost of your cab fare plus 10%. And explain to them, this is my carrying cost. I'm an architect, not a bank. I'm not making money on you with interest rates. I'm carrying your interest rates. So I'm going to charge you a 10% fee. 5%, depending on where it comes in. So I'll see anywhere between 0, 5, 10, 15. I've seen up to 20, But I rarely, if I'm representing the owner, I rarely let my client sign a 20% carrying fee. That's pretty high. Normally it's going to come in about 10%. How do you define the scope of work? You know, what are we all doing? You have to make sure we're all designing. Is it, you're sure it's a three-bedroom, two-bath? It's not a three-bedroom, three-bath. Does it have a deck? Does it have a attached garage? Make sure we define what that scope of services are going to be. Special cases. How many visits am I going to be in field? There's a section in the B101 in Article 4, it's like 4.2.3, I think it is, that says we're going to be on the project site this many times a week or this many times a month or what have you. I'm going to review the shop drawings twice only. After that, I get to charge you for it. So I get a shop drawing that is, here's how the brick wall is going to go up. Here's how we put together the brick. That's what your mason is going to put together the shop drawing. The architect gets in and looks at it and says, I don't have to check to make sure their weights are proper or the types of joints there are, but does this match what I designed? Is it within the design concept? Remember, reviewing the shop drawings, you don't check their math, but is it consistent with your design? No, I don't like the way it's done. You send it back to the mason because they haven't done it properly. They do another shop drawing. That comes back. You review it. Again, if it's good, you check and you say, yes, go ahead and build it this way. If it's not good, you said, I'm limiting my review to two reviews. If you send it back when they send it to you a third time, because you still have to approve it before they build it, you charge them an hourly rate. So you explain that to them. I'm only going to do two shop drawings review. It's common as two is the most common. Or when I go to look to see if the project is complete, one or two times, depending on the punch list and everything else. Reuse the drawings for additional phases. Copyright, we talked a little bit about that. If that comes up, if you think you're going to be doing a phase two, you want to build in, well, what would happen? You can pay me for a license for these if you want to hire somebody else. You can pay me to be your architect. I'm not redesigning, but I'm still going to charge you for these fees. So some of those things you can build in to the discussion, depending on the scope. And then what form of agreement? Is it going to be handshake, a letter, formal contract? Is it going to be the B101? Is it going to be the DBIA? Whatever form you're going to be using, those are things you want to talk to the client about so they understand. Small projects, you can use a B101 or a B104, or you can have your own contract you've created. And at the end of the class, I'll get you guys all a contract you can use forever and ever. So that's part of it. So those are things you got to tell the client to make sure they understand the terms of the deal. And then finally, you got to explain there's outside consultants. Are you going to be using them? So they have to understand. And you have to understand. What are the charges the consultant's going to charge? I have this advantage of long-term relationships. A lot of architects go back to the same structural engineer over and over and over because they have a good relationship. They understand the fees, they understand timing, because when the architect's going to take responsibility for their work, so you have to trust them and rely on them. They can have overages and inefficiencies, and so it's important for you to have that trust. What's included in their services? How many times are they visiting the project site? How many times are they going to be doing shop drawing review? Make sure you understand those things. What's their hourly rate? Is it the same as yours? You know, you're going to be explaining to them, well, you have a very specific structural design that you were looking for, this long, open truss space or whatever. We're going to have to bring in a high-paying, you know, somebody that's a high-charging engineer to do this because it's specialized work. So if you want this specialized design, I'm going to be bringing in an engineer that probably charges more than I do. Those are some things you need to understand to communicate to them. Contract has the same conditions. You want to make sure that your B101 and what you owe to the owner, that engineer owes to you. Because you don't want to do is say, I promise you, owner, I'm going to do this, and it covers everything, and then your structural engineer doesn't do that. They're not making that promise. So there has to be this concept of what's called flow-down provisions. So important provisions in your owner-architect agreements need to be in the architect-consultant agreement. What's great about the AIA documents is they're already built in. They're a suite. For that document, use the C-Series. So you're already used, you have less worry about that when you go to them. And what you don't want to do is like enter into a B101 or whatever the AAA document is with your client, and then you go to your engineer and they say, we're going to use our form. You're like, no, we can't do that. Well, that's what we do. Well, but I'm using this. I need to make sure that the agreements mesh and they're the same. So that's something for consistency. What's your insurance? Does your insurance cover you and them? Do you pass the insurance down to them? Where do you do that? And then, obviously, you want to do your contracts in writing. So those are things you want to think about for the contract and what you do to get the deal done, and that you communicate those all to the client. And I believe that is it. Why is this not working? There we go. Any questions? All right. You guys enjoy your break.